Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Blog Talk Radio, Mathis Media Hub Radio, actually. This is Joanne Mathis. Beautiful day here in New Jersey, a little overcast, just a little. It's been very warm, but we're having a fantastic summer so far. How is yours? We're waiting on writer-poet Clint Smith. Clint Smith is a teacher. He's a writer and doctoral candidate at Harvard University. He is a 2014 National Poetry Slam champion and was a speaker at the 2015 TED Conference. You should hear his TED Talks. They are amazing. He has received fellowships from the National Science Foundation and the Kalalu Creative Writing Workshop. His poems and essays have been published or are forthcoming in The Guardian, Kinfolk's American Literary Review. He is just awesome, awesome, awesome. So let's bring him on now so we can get all the goods. Hold on. Hello, Clint. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing just great. I'm so glad you're on the show. I was looking at your TED Talks and listening to some of your poems and was blown out of the water. I was like, oh my God, this is just fantastic. But before we get to that, I want our listeners to know a little bit more about Clint Smith. Where were you born?
I was born and raised in New Orleans, Louisiana.
All right. And so did you, your education was in Louisiana. I know you grew up there, but where'd you go to school?
So I grew up, so my story is I grew up in New Orleans, born and raised. Hurricane Katrina was actually my senior year of high school. And so when I was 17 years old, I moved to Houston, Texas, along with my sister to live with my aunt and uncle, where we finished my senior year of high school. And then I went to Davidson College in North Carolina, where I played varsity soccer. I've been an athlete my entire life. And it's funny, actually, my entryway into the world of poetry and writing really came as a result of not getting a lot of playing time in college. I was the kid who very much thought he was going to grow up and be a professional athlete. And when that didn't happen, I had to figure out who I was beyond the soccer field, figure out who I was beyond sports in the classroom. And writing and poetry really became a refuge for me during college in a way that nothing else had ever been. And so then poetry became a huge part of my life. I lived in South Africa for a year after I graduated from college doing some public health work around HIV, yeah, AIDS and tuberculosis. And then I lived in Washington, D.C., where I taught high school English, 10th and 12th grade English, in Prince George's County, Maryland, right outside of D.C. And now I am just finished my first year of graduate school at Harvard, doing my PhD in education with a concentration in culture, institutions, and society. So thinking about specifically my research is around the intersection of education and incarceration and how people who teach in prison and prisoners make meaning of the purpose of education in incarcerated spaces. And how do these programs shape a prisoner's sense of agency, sense of self, sense of sort of like self-identity. And that's where I am now. So I just finished my first year up there.
Well, listen, I listened to your TED Talks and was blown out of the water, specifically a TED Talk that you did, The Danger of Silence. And you talked about Tell Your Truth. I thought, wow, this is really a great piece. Where do you come up with your poetry? How do you get into that? I've always wondered how a person put together the poetic phrase and all of that.
Yeah, so I've always loved writing, and I've always loved reading. Reading is always James Baldwin has a great quote, and I'm paraphrasing it here, where he talks about how you grow up and you think how your pain and your experience is unprecedented, in human history. And then you read and you realize that you're not alone. And I think that was especially true for me growing up and figuring out who I was in the world and feeling, and you know, feeling that like a lot of the things I was experiencing, I must be the only person. I must be the only person thinking about the world in this way. I must be the only person experiencing the world in this way. And books really just gave me an escape. You know, as cliche as it sounds, it really helped me see the world beyond my own reality and beyond the context that I lived in. And so, you know, from a super young age, my mom, if I had a question, I would go up to my mom and say, "Mom, well," I would ask her the question, and she'd say, she'd point to the encyclopedias on our bookshelf, and she'd say, "Go look it up." And so for me, reading and writing have always been associated with this notion of discovery and of figuring out who you are and figuring out how the world works. And I always loved the folks who were able to contribute to that, who were able to write things that people would see as resources, right? And I thought of the authors and writers who would write things that I would deeply resonate with. And I wanted to do that for other people. And so poetry, you know, became the sort of medium, specifically performance poetry became the medium that I think most viscerally moved me. And I remember the first time I ever saw a spoken word performance was in 2008 in New York City. And it was a woman who was doing a poem about having cerebral palsy. And I'll remember that in 3 minutes, the way I thought about an entire demographic of people completely changed. And it was remarkable to me that I could step into a room thinking about the world one way and leave that same room that the same evening thinking about the world completely differently. And I had never been moved by a piece of art that way. And so I said, you know, this is what I want to do. And I was a relatively awkward kid and had no performance background, but just practiced and went to shows and open mics and honed my skills in the shower with my roommate, you know, much to chagrin. And yeah, just really just committed myself to sort of self-improvement and craft. And yeah, I think about the same way anyone does when you're trying to improve in something, you study the people who've done it well. And so I just studied
performance poetry. You know, the danger of silence. Did you really give up speaking, or was that part of your performance poetry?
So when I was a kid, I saw Lent as a means of testing my willpower. And so I said, you know, sometimes I would give up McDonald's, sometimes I would give up soda. And I said, I'm going to give up talking. When I was a kid, it was, you know, and I did it in a sort of facetious way. And I tried to do it and, you know, failed within the first day. But for me, what it represented was a sort of recognition that I tried to give up speaking when actually there are so many times in my life where I'm already not speaking when I should. And so maybe I shouldn't be giving up speaking. Maybe what I should instead be doing is actually making it a point to speak up. And not be silent in so many times when I otherwise would be.
Right, because you you said, you know, instead of wanting to hear not what they needed, but, you know, what they were talking about. You know, I just made notes here. I thought that was a terrific TED Talk. Under 5 minutes, you changed my idea of giving up something, whether or not it was silence or whatever the case may be. But to me, it was more like, why don't you face the problem, talk about the issues that are going on, and not deaf ear to it. And then you went on to talk about, now this one really knocked me off my chair, how to raise a black son in America. Wow. Can we talk a little bit about that?
Sure.
So tell me more. I mean, it sounds very present. Now, this one was what, in 2015, this year?
Yeah, this one was just a few months ago.
Yeah, it's, you know, I was like, wow. Let's talk about raising a son in America. Is it as difficult today as it was when you were growing up, which is not long ago, but things change from one year to the next. How do you compare that?
Yeah, so I think one of my goal in that TED Talk was just an effort to bring attention to how people can live in the same world and experience it very differently. And so for me, you know, part of what it means to have empathy and to empathize across lines of difference with regard to race, class, socioeconomic status, gender, sexual orientation, is to step outside of yourself and to allow yourself to listen to the voices of other people, so that you can recognize that, like, while we may be walking down the same street, the way we experience that walk down the street as a result of who we are, what we look like, where we come from, could be very different. And I think that once people are grounded in a sort of understanding of that difference, then they find themselves more likely to sort of understand the plights of marginalized communities. And so really my goal in that was to sort of illuminate what it was like to be raised as a Black son in this country, for an audience that really that might not necessarily know. And that's what happened. I think I received, you know, hundreds of emails and comments from people saying, I had no idea. I had no idea that was how some people experience the world. And I think it's, you know, I think that's just important for all of us to be able to think about a world beyond ourselves.
I mean, the part when you talked about the super soakers, I mean, I could relate to that, but it was the way you put it forth, the way you spoke about it, and the camera turned to the audience, and I saw a couple of people, you know, it's like their jaw dropped, because why couldn't you play like your friends, you know? And of course, you said why, because you were a Black kid. And very powerful message. So when you go around to these different countries and you speak, you're talking about all sorts of situations in society or things you've experienced. So that's what your talks, you know, when you go around to different countries, that's basically what you bring with you, right?
Yeah, no, I just try to bring honesty to my experience. I try to bring just go and both share my experience and additionally to anytime I go to a place that's not my own, I really make it a point to listen to the experiences of other, that other people are having. And I think that that's how change takes place and how change occurs is that you have people who are listening to one another and working in partnership. Rather than sort of telling one another what they should or should not be doing.
So you have poems and essays that you have published as well, and of course it says The Guardian and Kinfolk's American Literary Review. What was it like when you got your first poem published? I mean, was that something that you expected at some point, or were you surprised?
Yeah, no, so I've actually only been writing or submitting work to be published for a little less than a year. And so, you know, a lot of my work before was meant to be performed. And because I'm someone who's never been comfortable in feeling compartmentalized by genre, I really wanted to make an effort to extend my work beyond the stage and to make sure that I was writing essays and writing short stories and writing poems that were meant to be read and rather than spoken aloud. And even though I think, you know, I think ultimately poetry is poetry, but it, you know, to write something for the page requires a sort of different aesthetic and sort of sensibility around the craft. And I remember the first time I got published, and it was an amazing feeling, you know. And it's a great and different sort of experience to watch someone. To read someone's work and to be able to sit with it and reread it and look at a line specifically and think about line breaks And it's just a sort of different artistic experience than to watch and listen to someone's work.
Do you feel like, I don't know, like you have arrived or you've been noticed? Is that any, did you have any feelings like that?
I wouldn't say I arrived. I think, you know, I'm deeply grateful for all of the opportunities that I've had. I'm deeply grateful for the platforms that I've been able to speak on and perform on. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, I'm grateful for them and I'm happy for them. But I also recognize that there's still more work to do. And that as a writer and as an artist, you're never finished growing. As a researcher, I'm never finished growing. I can always be better. And that the work that I'm committed to and the world that I'm hoping to play a part in building for my kids and for their kids and for their kids, is one that we don't live in yet. And so I'm, you know, I think it's okay to like take moments and say like, wow, I just did a TED talk. That's amazing. And I try to be sure to be present and take the time to appreciate those things. But also, you know, never getting caught up, to the point where I become bigger than the work, because ultimately the work is more important than my ego. It's more important than me. I'm secondary. I'm just someone who serves as a vessel, so to speak. And so I'm grateful that people resonate with the things I have to say. And I hope I can continue to create work that both pushes other people and pushes me.
Okay. Well, we're going to go to a commercial. And when we get back, I have a question for you. And it is, can writing be taught? Hold on.
All right.
Here is a well-documented fact. Humans spend approximately 33% of life in bed. That's a good reason to consider bringing your bed into the 21st century with Function All Linens. They'll change your bedtime forever. Designed for every kind of bedtime you can imagine, these fun and functional bed sheets have his and her side pockets that hold pretty much everything but the kitchen sink. The pockets allow you to have your cell phone, iPad, remotes, and anything else you need within your fingertips reach at all times. No more cluttered nightstands. No more fumbling around in the dark. Simply reach for your pocket. Experience the affordable comfort and pure luxury that only Function All Linens can offer. For more information or to order, visit functionall-linens.com or beddazzle.com.
All right, welcome back to Mathis Media Hub Radio. We're talking today to writer-poet Clint Smith. And Clint, can writing be taught? Now, there's a piece in The New Yorker that actually is written by Louis Menon is his name. And he talks about workshops versus schools, universities. And, you know, he says in workshops, there are writers who are non-published teaching other writers to be writers.
Hmm.
You know? And go ahead.
Yeah, no, I definitely think writing can be taught. I think writing is primarily something that is taught. I believe deeply in the idea of malleable intelligence. I believe deeply in the idea that I think a lot of times we have this conception of there being a ceiling that we can't go beyond intellectually or artistically. And I don't really believe in that. Certainly, you know, there's something you can say something for DNA and genetics. And I'm not saying that those are irrelevant, but I believe that one, we have literature and research that shows us that there are different ways of understanding intelligence, and that intelligence can be defined in a myriad of ways. And I think that all that same research is also showing us that in our brains, and what we're able to do with our minds is a lot more limitless than we first anticipated. So all that to say, I do think writing can be taught, and I think someone who commits themselves to the studying of the craft can certainly improve their work and their artwork in an incredible and sort of boundless way.
Mm-hmm. Because the University of Iowa Writers Workshop, you know, it's the most renowned creative writing program in the world, so they say.
Mm-hmm.
And they cranked out 16 Pulitzer Prize winners and all this stuff. But the school's official position is that the school has nothing to do with it. That, they said the fact that the workshop can claim as alumni nationally and internationally prominent poets, novelists, and short story writers is, we believe, more the result of what they brought here than what they gained from us.
Right.
So, I don't know. You know, I'm on the fence with that because there's still so much that goes on in a workshop. And this writer also goes on to say that he believes that writing is, I don't know, like a mill in an institution, in universities, rather. It's like a process where in the workshop is more of a sharing type of thing.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, no, I think that so something like the writing workshop really, because at that point in someone's career, you're really bringing together people who are already relatively established and sort of self-selective in the sense that you're bringing together a lot of people who already bring such mastery of the craft to the space. And then, right, what a place like an MFA program at University of Iowa does is just provide an opportunity for them to continue to grow and bounce ideas off of one another. So while Iowa might not be able to necessarily claim ownership of their prizes and their success, I don't think any place can claim ownership over those things because ultimately, the writer has to decide or not decide to do the work.
Right. Right, you're right. That makes sense. You're absolutely right about that. I don't know. It's a question of, for the writing community, And then, it goes on to say that there's a writer, I can't recall his name, but he's of an Indian, and he wrote a book. And he was criticized for it because, they said, how can you write a book about Indian culture because it wasn't authentic, but he is an Indian. He does have Indian culture. I don't know, and it's like, well, if you went to a university and all this other stuff, it's not respected in some way. I don't know. It's very confusing, but it's interesting. So there you go.
Indeed.
Yeah, indeed. So you were you experienced Hurricane Katrina as well.
I did. Yes. Apologize. I had to step outside. There's
construction
going on in my house.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I did experience Hurricane Katrina when I was 17.
Wow. And well, how was that for you? I mean, of course, it was horrific. But you said you went, you were able to get out and go to your aunt's or relative?
Yeah, I went to my aunt and uncle's house in Houston, and so it was a difficult experience. It was really traumatic in a way that I could not necessarily have. I don't think I truly understood until years later. When I was able to look back and really reflect on how that experience profoundly shifted the trajectory of my life in ways that I'm still only, beginning to understand. It's just being stripped and pulled away from the only place that you've ever called home. Well, certainly my family was, a lot more fortunate than some others in that we had family and resources that allowed us the opportunity to stay safe and stay warm, right, and stay sheltered when we were in Houston. Because there are a lot of families that were in the Astrodome or didn't have anywhere to go.
Wow.
But I think, our home was destroyed and it was, our house was under 10 feet of water, but I'm thankful you know, to be alive, and I'm thankful that I had a lot of people to support me in that transition time.
Wow. Have you ever written about it?
I've written some poems about it, yes, but, you know, mm-hmm. I think they never feel like they do it justice. So they're always works in progress.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because I'd be interested to, where are these poems? Where are they?
They're not online or anywhere yet.
Okay.
But hopefully soon.
Well, I look forward to that. So what's going on with you now for the future?
Yeah, so I'm, like I said, I'm currently getting my PhD at Harvard. I just finished my first year, and so I have a little while left to go. But I continue to travel around the country performing, doing poems and speaking and writing. And uh-huh. I'm working on my first full-length collection of poetry that hopefully will be coming out relatively soon. And really just continuing, and I teach in a prison in Norfolk, Massachusetts. And so really just trying to continue to incorporate my writing and my art and my teaching and my research to play my small part in sort of again building the sort of world that I want my kids and their kids to live in.
Wonderful. And the teaching in the prison, what are you teaching the MH about?
So I teach a creative writing course. So it's creative writing and literature.
Creative writing, okay.
Yeah.
That's really terrific. Are you finding a lot of talented, creative people? I'm sure you are.
Yeah, and they're some of the most brilliant people I know. And, you know, I think it pushes back against a lot of the preconceived notions that we have of who people who are in prison are and what they're capable of. And for me, it's always a source of learning and unlearning. A lot of the biases that we've all been deeply socialized to believe about what it means to be someone who's in prison.
Well, it's terrific that you're around to comfort them, you know, and give them that outlet that they need. So that's just terrific. Well, our time is up. Can you believe that went really fast, didn't it?
Oh, wow.
Okay.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely, and I'm so glad that you came by. Please come back again, maybe when your book comes out. Who knows, right?
Indeed. Right. I would love that.
Okay, Clint. Right. Thank you so much. Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right, you've been listening to writer-poet Clint Smith. And, I forgot to ask him. You can find his stuff in The Guardian, Kinsfolk, and also TED Talks. So check out his TED Talks. You'll be very pleased. All right. Well, thank you for listening to Mathis Media Hub Radio. Have a wonderful rest of your day.
Thank you for listening. This has been a Mathis Media Hub production.